Dr. Rachel Yehuda, a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, has done significant research in the field of epigenetics, finding that in our DNA, genes can be turned on and off and expressed differently through changes in environment and behavior. Her research focused on the intergenerational transmission of trauma and discovered that serious incidents of trauma, such as that experienced by Holocaust survivors, and the resulting post-traumatic stress can be passed down through the generations in shared family genes for years. Sociologist Dr. Joy DeGruy followed on to this, penning the phrase post-traumatic slave disorder to address the specific trauma suffered by descendants of black slaves. The research has revealed that when people experience trauma, it actually changes their genes in very specific and noticeable ways, changes which are then transmitted to their children and the effects passed down from one generation to another. So, what in the world does this have to do with this topic? Well, stay tuned. I hope to tie it all together for you, but it could be a wild ride. So why are we here? And I don't mean in some cosmic, universal, existentialist way. I mean, why are you here? Why are you here in this room today? I decided to speak on this topic because it's kind of a selfish reason, maybe. No, I really wanted to share. I wanted those very words to appear on the sign out front on West Saanich Road. I think we have something special here at First Unitarian, something that we want to share with the broader community. So much so that I sometimes wonder why this room is not standing room only on Sundays. I mean, I know it's summertime and we've got the Camp Pringle thing going on and, you know, people are busy. It's not just me, I think, I hope.
You're good.
Okay. But why aren't our community dinners overflowing into the parking lot? Why do we only have 7 or 8 neighborhood groups? I think that's what we have. Or why isn't it a dozen? Why isn't it 2 dozen? It's 12? Well, then why isn't it 24, for gosh sakes? See, I wanted those words to be out front because we know that a large and growing portion of the population identifies with those words. And I think that phrase describes what we have to offer. And I'll speak more on that later. There are essentially 2 groups within the spiritual but not religious crowd. Those who are coming into the movement, if we can call it that, who've never been a part of a church or other religious group. And then those who come from having some life experience inside organized religion. Of the latter group, I know that there are some of you here, like Karen and Maddo, who were raised Unitarian Universalists. And actually, show of hands, who else in the room have been a UU all your lives? Precious few. Hopefully we're going to have more as time goes on. Others, such as myself, have come to Unitarian Universalism from other religious background. As Maddo mentioned in her introduction, I was raised in the Lutheran Church, but in my young adult years, I gradually fell away from that faith, largely because of the rigid clinging to old beliefs about the origin of the universe and the threat of eternal damnation for all unbelievers. Those beliefs stood in stark contrast to my own observations of the natural world and my sense of injustice at the idea that a so-called jealous God would torture forever the innocents that did not have the opportunity to believe. Yeah. For many of us who followed that path, I'm not trying to make fun. I'm not poking fun. It's a meme. It's the internet. It's not me. For many of us who followed that path, the ex-religious group, we have rejected the rigid dogma of organized religions in favor of, well, something else. Across millennia, humans have always been seeking some path to the divine. Archaeologists have found evidence of religious practices dating back thousands and thousands of years. Religion and mythology are nearly universally widespread and evidently present across the span of human history. And it could not have gotten that way unless it was fulfilling some important human need. Today in North America, at least, the SBNR movement and those who identify as nuns with respect to religious affiliation continues to grow, reducing the ranks of traditional religious groups. An Angus Reid poll 4 years ago found that 39% of Canadians identify as spiritual but not religious. Certainly one reason is that of generational replacement, social and cultural shifting through time as the traditions of the past are questioned and abandoned. One is no longer shunned by your community for not belonging to a church. Well, in many places. Certainly that still happens in certain communities. But this is a significant factor in the growth of the religiously unaffiliated. People are no longer holding on to an appearance of faith just because of social pressure. So what does it mean to be spiritual but not religious? I bet there are as many definitions as there are people who claim the title. But it is following the path of a seeker. To discover truths that are higher than ourselves, to look within ourselves to find that still small voice inside, a seeking perhaps for what is missing in our lives. Think about how you would define it for yourself. But why? Why do we claim this, and why is it growing? Some say that the opposite of a spiritualistic life is that of a materialistic life, eschewing any notion of the interconnected web of which we are all a part and living a completely secular life. And sure, there's plenty of folks living that way, but that's not us. But why are we seeking? Well, I don't think people just go out looking for a spiritual journey. It's not like picking up a new hobby or a sport like, oh, I think I'll try knitting or rock collecting or painting or Taoism. No, from what I can see, people seek because they can't help it. It's not like a road trip seeking after fun or for something to do. It's more like seeking after something you've lost or coming to a sense that there must be more. Perhaps we have a deep-seated feeling that something was missing or incomplete in our lives, that there's a bigger reality out there or in here that we have to find. In popular culture and spiritual circles, there seems to be an increasing awareness of the spiritual aspect of life. At the same time, it seems that the materialistic world and the never-ending hunger for more this or more that is eating away at our very lives, and most troubling, the health of the planet. But more people are becoming aware of, or believe, that we're living in a special time in human history, that we're at the cusp of a change between an overly materialistic society to a more spiritually oriented one. Supposedly, more and more people are waking up. The phrase woke, or get woke, or this, has found its way into popular culture. Now, if you don't get the AF reference, you can ask some youngster. We're not going to talk about it here. Now, woke can have several meanings, but one that you can, but one is that you can see things in society as they really are, not through some rose-colored lens. But my first interpretation is that it's about those who are having some level or experience of spiritual enlightenment. But I'm afraid the social colloquialism of woke has taken on a far more superficial meaning. But folks have to start somewhere. So we're all seeking something, connection or inspiration or life meaning. I'd like you to consider a hypothesis. And that's where we come back to my opening comments about that DNA research. Point one. So, what we're learning about DNA is that it changes over time in response to its environment and our behaviors. Consider that the DNA of black Americans today carries the marks of over 200 years of abduction and slavery, committed upon generation upon generation. And if a generation is roughly 30 years, then this impact on DNA occurred over 7 generations. A long time of unimaginable suffering for certain, and enough time to leave its mark still today. But not a long time in the entire span of human history. And the impacts of the Holocaust, which occurred over somewhat less than 10 years, are seen in the DNA of the survivors and their offspring. Point 2. Imagine what life was like 3,000, 10,000, 25,000, 100,000 years ago, or more. A quote from the New York Times. The first human ancestors appeared between 5 million and 7 million years ago, probably when some ape-like creatures from Africa began to walk habitually on 2 legs. They were flaking crude stone tools by 2.5 million years ago. Then some of them spread from Africa into Asia and Europe about 2 million years ago. With somewhat less certainty, most scientists think that people who look like us, anatomically modern Homo sapiens, evolved by at least 130,000 years ago from ancestors who had remained in Africa. Their brain had reached today's size. They too then moved out of Africa and eventually replaced other human species, such as the Neanderthals. Modern human history is sometimes slated to have begun around the end of the last ice age, about 10,000 years ago. And I often wonder what life was like back then. You know, we can put pieces of the puzzle back together from artifacts, but we don't know for certain. Years ago, I read and was fascinated by Gene Owl's The Clan of the Cave Bear books, which painted a fascinating conjectural portrait of what life may have been like back then. Out of curiosity, I thought, I'm going to see what the internet says. So I searched the web for why early humans lived in groups. You got to love the internet. For socializing, they didn't have WhatsApp, Facebook, and Twitter, so they used to make group and hang out and dance. Sounds legit to me. But humans are social creatures. The group provided protection, shelter, division of tasks, and the ability to gather enough food to survive. Our small tribes came together periodically in gatherings of an extended tribe in a geographic area. We traded in tools, in food, in clothing, in knowledge, in stories, and most importantly, genetics. Marriages were made. We initiated our young. Each smaller group traveling long distances to come together in such gatherings. So early humans came together in family groups and extended tribes for protection, for learning, food gathering. Then as now, we do it for survival. And we've done it for millions of years. Sure, our understanding of the world has changed, but slowly over countless generations. We learn as time goes on within our small social group, and we learn from our connection to larger social groups in the exchange of ideas about the physical and spiritual world. Passing that down from generation to generation, the traits, the skills, the behaviors, and the DNA that allowed our species not just to survive, but thrive for millions of years. And oh yes, we've thrived. We were fruitful and multiplied. Let's look upon how prosperous we've been. And how do we live today? We largely live lives of separation. My children are in Washington, my sister's family in Northern California, my brother is in Arizona, and most of my living relatives are in Wisconsin. Generations living today that contain that of my parents to grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and I think there's some great-great-grandchildren in there too, spread far and wide across the continent. How about you? Imagine what life was like when our extended family unit still lived together, at each other's throats sometimes, I'm sure, but still every life event was shared in this group. And our family was part of a larger tribe of other families. We were connected. Every aspect of life shared with one another. Every aspect of life. Now, I don't want to over-romanticize life back then. What do they say? It was brutal, harsh, and short, something to that nature. Much of our understanding of these living social units come from our analysis of remains and ruins. But we can't imagine, can't we? My gosh, just imagine waking up every day, greeting each other, eating together, planning the day, what would be best for our people, and sharing in every activity and event, every joy, every sorrow, every birth, and every death together for thousands of years. Living in these tightly bound groups where cooperation and connection enabled our very survival, we also worshiped. We shared our spiritual view of the world. Our shamans and elders initiated us in the way of our tribe for thousands of years. And then we shared our experiences through storytelling and gatherings of our extended clan for thousands of years. Can you imagine what kind of connection existed among us? The need for familial connection is so strong and such a deep-seated need that today it has even spawned businesses that cater to the need, such as the Rent-A-Family service in Japan. This is a real thing, and I don't know whether to laugh or cry about that. Now, do you think with what we now know about how DNA can be affected by our environment and our behaviors, do you think those thousands and thousands of years of connection have left their mark on us today? I think they do. Were we aware of our connection together back then? Did we know what it meant? Did we fully feel in our hearts that connection? Maybe we did. But where is that connection now? Largely missing in our lives today. And when did that start? When was it that began the separation of these tribal units? Maybe it was at the advent of agriculture about 10,000 years ago. And maybe it's made more significant with every so-called revolution and social change in human history through the Industrial Revolution, through the Industrial Revolution, and now through the never-ending technological revolution. Along the way, we maintained the connections we could within our families, certainly, within groups of immigrants, and from the darker side of humanity in groups by race. Now it seems we are only becoming more and more tribal along those lines, and not based on familial relationship or geographic territory. We are separating into groups defined by judgments of the others, by opinion, by belief, separation. Maybe in the theme of you don't know what you've got till it's gone, humanity has had to lose it to find it again. Back in my days as a Lutheran youth, I recall wondering why there were so many religions, and even within Christianity, why were there so many denominations and sects? We all read the same or mostly the same Bible, but we came up with so many different interpretations. I would think if God was so powerful and all-knowing, and he wanted us to believe in him and worship him, why didn't he just come on down here now and then and not just in a 2,000-year-old story about it, and say, okay, here I am. Yep, all me, the real thing. Time to worship me. No metaphor, no allegory. Here's the gig. Bow down, worship. And stop killing each other in my name. Let's just chill. Would save a whole lot of trouble. Well, but at least he's got a Facebook page now. So, hard to see. But what I've come to realize about a true faith is that it has to resonate here, not here. It has to be discovered, uncovered, tested, refined, and lived. That process that some early Christians called gnosis, a deep-seated, heartfelt knowing of what was true for oneself. And while a spiritual path is very personal, the steps are quite often difficult. The path of discovery needs others, because togetherness is what we seek. It's in our DNA. And if we're going on this journey together, we need a map. We need some guidance. And it just so happens that we have some. As UUs, we may not have a rigid dogma of belief, but we do have our principles. When we come together in this community, in our small group ministries, whether in our neighborhood groups, our chalice circles, or our other relationships, our principles inform our behavior. Respect for each other, compassion and non-judgment, safety, love. These are the necessary ingredients. For it is in authentic and compassionate sharing in the lives of each other that we build or replenish our connection to the whole. That deep, meaningful connection with others is truly what we are seeking. And experiencing that, we experience a deep heart healing and an abundant life.